So, welcome everyone. Today we're doing a takeaway about audits, which will be quite interesting. It's a really interesting area. There's tons to talk about. So we're going to have to make sure we structure the conversation properly. And we're aiming to cover off how to get the most out of your audit. So we're going to talk a bit about audits and this and the next. I'm joined by one of our senior consultants and Dave Holmes, the consulting manager, and by Ollie, another consultant with us. So say hi, please, you guys.
Hi, everybody. Thank you for joining us today.
Yeah. So what we're going to do first, we normally kind of cover off a bit of stuff, but being in the news, and hopefully you've been reading the news, Ollie, Dave, Dillick, because I haven't really, to be honest. I've been head down doing other stuff most of this week. So what's caught your attention or your eye in the news this week?
What's caught my attention, I don't know if you've seen it as well, Phil, but there was a leaked, potentially claiming it was a leaked report by the FT reporting that the UK is to be granted adequacy with the EU for a period of 4 years and a cyclical period for 4 years, which is quite interesting. Hopefully, if we do get adequacy, it'll certainly make transfers of information to and from the EU a bit simpler and a bit easier.
Didn't that say that they're expecting to get that through before the end of April? That adequacy.
They said it. The article that I read said it was due imminently. But they didn't say how imminent was. So it says it looks like the UK is are going to be granted adequacy, and it'll be assessed every 4 years.
Right, very good. Anything else you've seen that you want to chat about?
Yeah, the other thing I've seen, and it may affect some of our clients potentially, especially if you're selling goods and services into the EU, is that the EC has agreed the proposal for the new e-privacy regulation. Well, say the new e-privacy regulation. It feels like it's been going around years, but they've just never got to agreeing it. So it's kind of set out a lot of the stuff. Generally, what we already know, so you need consent for electronic direct marketing. There's a soft opt-in in there. You've got member states can set the expiry date on when the soft opt-in expires, where you're using that element of it. Other bits that are normal about direct marketing calls to have identifiable codes or prefixes. So some of it's generally the same. It doesn't appear to have massively moved in many areas, but we do need to keep an eye on the privacy regulation because it will apply across EU member states. We're no longer an EU member state, but we're selling goods and services into the EU. It may well potentially be caught. Or if you've got EU partners and a setup in the EU and marketing in the EU, then you'll certainly need to be aware of when the privacy regulation becomes into force. I did read, though, that it may well have a 2-year leading period similar to the GDPR. So if it does come into force, it will apply immediately.
I'm glad you raised that, Dave, because I picked up on that and I read through the e-privacy regulation as it now stands. And why do you need a 2-year leading? I mean, everyone's doing it now anyway, aren't they? And there's not material change. What I noticed, though, is that the kind of default in Article 16 about unsolicited communications is the default is you need consent, even for person-to-person live calls. But there's a piece in the article that says, but member states can carve that out as not requiring consent, subject to safeguards and provisions. So they've kind of moved, ratcheted up a little bit, haven't they?
They have,
I'm not sure what this means in practice, but Article 17 of the new e-privacy regulation, information about detected security risks. So in the case of a particular risk that compromises security of a network or communication services, the provider has to inform the end users about those risks. So that seems to me that if there's kind of some kind of perceived risk that the telecommunications providers are aware of, then they've got a legal obligation to tell everyone about it. That's how I read it anyway. Did you see that one?
I did, yeah. I was surprised because, there will be bits in there that might take a little longer to kind of get your head around and understand what it actually means in practice. From the telco side of things, I think from the EDM side of things, so the electronic direct marketing, I don't think it's a great fundamental change, to be fair.
Nothing really, are there?
No. I don't think so. One thing that kind of stood out, but it's kind of a bit of common sense, is that member states must provide that the legitimate interest of the end users who are legal persons must be sufficiently protected with regards to receiving electronic direct marketing. So there's some measures around that. But I would have potentially suggested, as we do anyway, that's most likely just going to be an opt-out.
And what do you think will happen here? Do you mean the e-privacy regulation would directly affect you if you were undertaking direct marketing or, you know, applying cookies to EU based people. But do you think the pecker will change? I should imagine it will.
I imagine it will, because the agreement for the trade agreement between the EU and the UK said that they'll keep laws aligned, didn't they, for a period of time at least. So I think in order to keep laws aligned, I'm not suggesting that they're just going to wholeheartedly accept it, but they'll probably take elements of it to update PECA generally, because it came out in 2003 and it's had hundreds of amendments, or appears to be hundreds of amendments.
It's had loads, hasn't it?
So I would have thought it'd been simpler just to kind of give it a general update anyway, in line with what EU is, in line with the directions of the EU, just so we've still got this kind of similarity of laws in order to ensure that we maintain an adequacy statement.
Yeah, poor old Ollie's gonna have to do all that cookie and script work again, Ollie.
Please don't, Phil. Please don't. I put a call to Dave just about an hour ago, ranting to him about it. There is something quite interesting to have come out of it all, though, and I think it kind of ties into what you're saying, essentially, about where the PEC is going to get an update, which is, I'm not sure how big of a deal that might be in the end, because as we've seen with a lot of other things, it's becoming very supply chain led on this sort of thing.
Yeah.
So two of the big changes recently, one I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, which is that Google are moving away from personally identifiable information in cookies, and they're moving to this cookie privacy sandbox mechanism, which they're trialing, which has really ruffled the feathers of the CMA. They're not particularly happy about that, because it's going to make marketing much more difficult for them. And then the other side of this is what I've been looking into this morning, which is admittedly interesting, although I've probably spent a little bit too long looking at it, which is that the latest iOS update, which is coming, I think, sometime in the spring, iOS 14.5, is going to change how app developers are able to use cookies and similar technologies. So basically now you're going to be required, I mean, you're already required to get consent if you're applying the law properly, but now Apple are actually forcing you to implement prompts which get user consent for tracking purposes. And they're also applying that to app attribution mechanisms. So that's all changing and all quite interesting. But yeah, I've probably had enough of cookies for the time being.
So just on that, Ollie, and I absolutely agree, because I went through it with you earlier, but kind of related to that, do you see then with the way the laws are changing and with how you need consent for cookies, that it's kind of going to be the death of the cookie in that kind of sense? It's going to lead to new technologies developing in order to find ways to do attribution for spend for marketing purposes, but without using cookie technology or similar in that sense.
Yeah, absolutely. 100%. So one thing that I've uncovered as part of this, and this might be known to people on the call, and if it is, I apologize for sort of bringing it up again. But one thing that I came across is that a lot of it comes down to reading something called an advertiser ID on iPhones in particular. So that's an individual reference number which each iPhone user has, which allows them to be tracked across applications. Now that in and of itself is caught by the cookies and similar technologies banner, but what Apple are now doing is they're moving away from that, because they can control that number. They're saying to advertisers, if you come to us and work with us, we'll allow you to track our users, but we're going to do it in a way which is privacy conscious, in that we won't allow you to collect that information directly. So clearly
Cynical. That sounds like they're trying to corner the advertising market.
There is that. But, you know, that's just the natural order of things, I suppose.
Just following the money, I think.
Yeah, I would say so. I did see a couple of other interesting bits in the news this week. One sort of quite interesting coming out of the CNIL, because as regular listeners know, that's my favourite stomping ground. They this week have handed down a warning to a football club who were looking at using facial recognition technology to identify people who are banned from the grounds or potential terrorist threats. And they were looking to implement these facial recognition cameras. The CNIL basically said, no, you're not doing that. That's completely disproportionate.
That's interesting.
We've seen quite a lot of traffic recently through our support desk and other functions relating to using facial recognition technology in tandem with temperature taking devices for COVID purposes. So it's interesting to see how this might all develop, I think.
Yeah, I was looking at that. I spoke to somebody yesterday about it, and now also actually linked into access control. So effectively, you know, employee rocks up and the system reads their face and measures their temperature and either lets them in the building or doesn't.
Yes.
And I was like, extracting everything. Well, if it's not good enough for policing purposes, this facial recognition technology, you know, it seems a very frivolous use of stunning technology just to, you know, replace the plastic. And if the system gets hacked and your facial recognition digital features get compromised, unless you're going to give everybody facial surgery, your whole security strategy, authentication methods are flawed. So I can't see why you would bother to. Anyway, they ever told my funny story in the past. So when I was talking about football clubs, when I used to work the data protection officer at Everton, and I went along to the ICO conference. No, I went to London, and I bumped into David Smith, the assistant commissioner at the time, assistant information commissioner at the time, and I deliberately went over and had a chat with him about football and wanted to get Everton on the kind of on the map, really, as good people in terms of data protection. So we had a bit of a chat, and then I bumped into him on Euston Station when we were back up to Liverpool. And he said, "Oh, yeah, I keep meaning to ask you, how does blacklisting of banned supporters work in your industry? Is there a kind of a common blacklist?" So, "Oh, I'm a train sailor, I've got to go." But there's no way I'm getting involved in that discussion with him.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anyway, Dilly, what have you?
I was just going to say, I was going to finish on a more amusing story that I saw this week, and just a very quick one.
What, more amusing than mine?
Potentially. I thought this was quite funny. I don't know if anyone else has seen this, but I saw a story about a guy in England who was offered a COVID jab recently, despite seemingly being healthy and not a particular risk. And he sort of thought, well, that's a bit odd that I'm being offered it so early when I should be, you know, quite far down the list. Turns out that his GP surgery had incorrectly recorded his height of 6'2" as 6.2 centimetres, giving him a BMI of something like 28,000. So he was extremely
Yeah, I remember seeing that.
Yeah, so kind of highlights the data accuracy thing, eh?
That is funnier than yours, Phil, sorry.
Okay. Fine, moving on. Dilly, what have you noticed anything? We've got to get on with auditing in a minute, but yes. what have you seen? Yes.
The only thing is around the Scottish Council issuing an apology for a data breach. They sent out emails to about 600 people who should have been BCC'd, but they all were visible about some form of eligibility to payments. So, again, drives the message of making sure we check, because that's a high volume of individuals. So 600 customers got their emails exposed.
All right. Now, auditing. So,
Phil, I was going to say,
of course, yes.
Considering I undertake the audits, I have put together kind of like an 8-step for auditing, or at least 8 things to consider when auditing. If you'd like, you can go through these or interject as you wish, or
Whatever, interject as you wish. I mean, the first starting point is, you know, why are we doing this? How are we doing it? Who's doing it, I suppose? Mm-hmm. I want to kind of cover off, you know, what frameworks, you know, what are the control objectives that we're working to here? And, you know, how do you conduct an audit? I mean, people are probably fully aware of it, but, you know, what is it you're looking for? And that's probably your 8-step process, because I've got a similar 8-step focus. And then there's probably tricky areas, like, well, how do you audit privacy by design and by default, for example? And then finally, you know, ultimately, how do you get the most out of your audits? You know, what is it you should be doing to make them work in the organization? So I wanted to try and approach it like that without wanting to be too rigorous about it. So, I mean, first off, I'm looking for someone to point out where, if anywhere, auditing or compliance checking is mentioned in the UK GDPR. I'm looking to all of you, actually, not everyone. I mean, Ollie, Dave, and Dilik. And if you know any thoughts on that? I mean, it is quite clear in my view. Article 24.1, Article 31D. You know, it talks about, it doesn't use the word audit, but it does, you know, refer to checking that your control measures are working.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Sorry, Phil. I was just jumping in there. So, yeah, for sure. It kind of, in essence, links to the accountability, isn't it? So if you're looking at, can you demonstrate how you meet the requirements of Ladog? Well, how do you demonstrate that? What measures do you have to put in place? And is that necessarily just a framework? Do you meet the larger Bavna framework in place? Or do you have to demonstrate that the framework is working in that sense? So you, do you have your policy and procedures? Are you adhering to your policy and procedures? Are your governance measures effective, and are they maintained and reliable in that sense? It doesn't necessarily have to use the word audit. You could use the word compliance checks or such forth in that sense. It didn't necessarily have to be explicit saying an audit, but it's kind of, to me, it's all encompassed within that accountability element and the elements of within the GDPR. It says you've got to do this. For example, you must ensure that you've got appropriate technical and organisational measures in place. Well, how do you ensure that?
Yeah, and what does it say about those specifically? This is in Article 32, which again makes you wonder: is auditing restricted to Article 32, a process for regularly testing, assessing, and evaluating the effectiveness of the tech and org measures? That's what it says in Article 32. But I mean, my view is it applies across the whole of the GDPR, you know, and we should be auditing privacy information and ROPAs and everything else. So I think you're right, Dave, for accountability.
Sorry, I was just going to say, I don't mean to jump in there as well. For me, when you're looking at audits and compliance checks, whatever it is, for me, a starting point is, well, what are you actually trying to achieve? What's the end goal? What you're trying to get to in order to work out what the thing is and what it needs to be? And whether that's going to be a superficial look. So can you just do an audit and tell me what I've got in place? Fine, yeah, you've got policies and procedures in place. Or did you want more of an in-depth kind of a deep dive review of, are my policies and procedures relevant? Are they workable? Are they being adhered to? Are people following them?
Which you're probably stealing Dilik's 8-point plan.
No,
here,
that's all right.
I'll stop on you, Dilik. I'll let you join.
No, I completely agree that you need to know what you're auditing. But then again, a lot of the time when I do undertake audits, a lot of the time people kind of they have an assumption that they are compliant in some areas, but not all areas. An audit is just a mechanism to kind of, okay, well, let's identify those gaps. Let's figure out where our gaps are. Whilst I'm familiar in this area, a lot of the time when I undertake audits, the audit lead or the individual internally wasn't aware of these other gaps that they were that was raised in the findings. So it is really a way to just scoop up and see whether there are any gaps with the law. Is there anything that you should be focusing on? And also, are we familiar with the risks and do we define them and do we address them? And the audit is a mechanism that's going to help you achieve that, find those gaps.
Yeah, good. Someone's just mentioned about 27701, which is an interesting standard, actually, because it's an international standard, but it's only applicable as an extension of 27001, isn't it? So if you're not 27001 certified company, yes, you could, I suppose, work to the standards of 27701, but you know the certification mechanism is intrinsically tied into 27001. I rather like, and I have done for 11 years since it was published, 10,012 as a standard as well. So there's two good standards out there, 27701 and BS 10,012, which are a good framework to measure against. And I might have said this last week as well, way back when, and I think it must be like 2001, the ICO published an absolutely fantastic audit handbook with loads of, I've shown you it, haven't I, Dilik? Loads of templates and checklists. And okay, it's all focused on DPA 98, but it's got in there audit methodology, how to do audits. It's a really good piece of work, and you can still get it as a PDF. And if anyone wants it, and it's worth a read, and if you want it and you can't find it, then we've got it in our library, so we can circulate it if people want to have a quick look at that. So we're doing audits because we think they're a good idea, and also because we're probably told to do them in the GDPR, aren't we? So we kind of like, that's the why we're doing it. I think we're getting into the how and the who now, aren't we? So,
yeah, if you want me to go into my point one, I'll go in point one and we'll see what your point one is, Phil. Yeah. My one is, so once you have defined that you do want an audit, you've identified that an audit is required, whether that's because you want to just check your compliance controls against the requirements of the laws, or whether management need a way of obtaining oversight over compliance. So regardless, let's say you've defined that you do need one. The next, I think, is very critical, is at the very beginning, is to clearly define what is actually in scope and what is out of scope, and the objectives as well. A lot of the times, I think you want everything and all captured, but that's not going to be reasonable in the audit time or the audit period or the resources.
I think,
so it's about defining the scope.
Yeah, a fantastic point. And actually, scope is planning is top of my list. I've broken it into three bits: scope, methodology, and output. So I think you're absolutely right. You know, if you go in, people think we can go and do a gap analysis. And actually, I have to say, I can walk into somewhere and get a real good feel of where the where the issues are, where to look to find the non-compliant areas, as you can as an auditor.
Yeah.
But defining the objective, you know, what is it we're trying to achieve here? What is it we're looking at? Are we looking at a sample of stuff? We're looking at everything. We're looking departmentally. We're looking functionally. We're tagging ourselves to a bit of data and following it through the organization.
That is the one thing I clarify is the scope. Which departments are in scope, especially if they are geographically based or if they are based in multiple locations, what properties, what premises, what departments, what people are in scope of the audit so that you can clearly define where you are. As much as I do get that often, you know, we can't audit all of them. You have to just select a certain amount. Well, so it's about guessing.
Yeah. And that comes down to methodology, doesn't it, as well? Yeah. So how are you going to undertake the audit? You're going to interview people, you're going to inspect evidence, you know, so records. And if you're inspecting evidence and records, how many, you know, what percentage of records are you going to look at in order to determine whether or not an organization is compliant with the retention principle, for instance? You know, where, how are you going to do that? So I think organizing and agreeing your method is also important. And I think the method, I think, and you might all disagree with me or have a different view, but I think the method might vary depending on what it is you're looking at. So you know, looking at breaches, you might use a different method. You're looking at privacy notices, you might look at different method views, you know, assessing training and awareness measures. So I think that's why, you know, I think ultimately you kind of need some form of checklists or manuals, you know, to help people make sure that your audits are consistent time and time again.
I'd say that about 9 out of 10 of the clients that request an audit know exactly what is in scope and what's out of scope. There are some that are, you know, might be unsure about that, but I agree with you, Phil. The methodology, usually that is defined, but I would say just make sure it's clear. The scope is clear. The objectives are clear. And also what you want out of the audit, what you want out of it. For example, are we doing a high level one? Are we doing recommendations, departmental? Are we aiming for a particular audience? For example, are we doing the compliance audit? Sorry, the audit of it. For exec level, management level, or, you know, really do define all of that right at the beginning. So the clarity stays, and also throughout the audit, you will make sure that we could go back to that scope and remain within that scope. It's almost like you're setting the scene.
Yeah, and I think Marie's very kindly highlighted the ICO's current audit guidelines, but and that's focused on them doing consensual audits of different organisations. And again, that's great. And that is a defined scope with a defined objective and a defined methodology. But doing internal audits or us doing external audits of our clients, you know, again, it's useful to see that, but it doesn't go far enough, in my opinion. I'm interested, Dilik, in terms of output, this notion of, because I know we rate it on our reports, partial compliance. I mean, a lot of this is Boolean. You're either compliant or you're not. There's either evidence of compliance, or there's evidence of non-compliance, or there's no evidence of compliance. They're the only three outcomes, really, aren't they?
Phil, you have skipped well ahead. So the first thing I would say, you're skipping well ahead. No wonder why we need to tame you in a bit. So your first one is your scopes, objectives, methodology, exactly what Phil said. The next one is to think about, I mean, I'm talking as if I'm kind of asking you to do an audit, but I'm just going to go through the process. I do this. So it's to define your time period. So it's the time frame. You know, we have clients that want a 2-day audit. We have some that want a... We have clients that want an audit in 2 days or a gap analysis in 2 days. We have some that do it over the 5 or 6 days. You know, that time period or the length of the audit that you want is going to impact what's going to come out of the audit. So if you are going to go for a 2-day audit and you want a high level gap analysis across multiple disciplines, then that's going to produce something a very high level with maybe a more additional high level recommendations. Whereas if you want an audit focused in 2 days and you want it to be focused in a specific area, then you will have more tailored, more specific risks or recommendations and non-conformities. So really how long you want your audit to take place, because 2 days is great, 3 days pushing it. I like the 5 days and more because it gives me the opportunity to really delve in and fish out evidence and to prove compliance.
And that comes back to objectives. And again, looking for Ollie and Dave here to comment as well. But if your objective is give us a quick and dirty broad brush approach, highlight where we definitely need to do work, you know, then that's fine. You know, we could do that. If you want a thorough, detailed, you know, compliance audit to demonstrate to the board that, you know, everything in every area is as it should be, then that's a much bigger job, isn't it?
Yeah.
Committing time is my number two as well. This is really how to get the most out of your audit. I think, you know, put time into it. I think communicating in advance is my number three, Dilik. You know, make sure that all your colleagues know what's going on, because there's nothing more frustrating and wasting of everyone's time and money by turning up and asking for evidence or asking to see people and they're busy doing something else or on holiday. That's happened to me.
Yeah, that's the line. It's so freaky, Phil, I said, because it's actually my third one is very similar to yours. But my second one, I'm just going to add on to that. You know, the quality of what you will get will also vary on the length that you do provide. So that's number two. So number two is get, you know, have an idea of how much you want to commit in terms of time and also, you know, what is it you want in return? Because I do have clients that say, right, okay, I want a list of all my gaps. I want a list of do's and, you know, list of all of those and what I'm doing wrong. Well, I can't do that in a 1 day audit. It's very high level, but, you know, it's about kind of being mindful. I'm going to jump on Phil's one in terms of people. Now, the thing is about resource, you know, audits, ensure that they are adequately resourced and not resourced in terms of just budgeting, but people time as well. You know, try and factor in anything that's key developments around the organization. You know, I mean, I have client meetings where we have to reschedule certain things and certain impact assessments or other data protection related stuff because it's the end of the month or it's payroll or they are transitioning or part of a migration project. Therefore, that kind of does hinder sometimes or impact our meetings. In terms of the audit, I would advise that they are organized around certain key moments or developments in the organization. Because if you've got people who are committed to other areas and then you drag them in for data protection, normally not a fan of us.
Yeah. What's your number four then?
So number four is roles and responsibilities, making sure that these are clearly defined. So we definitely need your leadership management level responsibilities defined. What part do they play in this? What drive are they going to be putting through? But also who is going to manage that audit? It does take up a lot of time. You've got kickoff meetings, you've got catch-up meetings, you've got time to organize meetings, you've got all of this stuff. So this is going to consume time. So you need to make sure that somebody is dedicated and has that capacity. The next is, well, once the audit is done, once it's all done and you get this, you know, I would say nice looking report and you got all your risks and recommendations and conformities, who is going to be responsible for leading that, to drive that, to coordinate that? Who is going to be? Because a lot of the time I see once any auditing has been done, it's usually bolted onto someone's already busy time scale. So it's about saying, okay, so we need to be mindful that we will get some recommendations or non-conformities. We have to make changes. And it's about making sure that, do we have the resources to do that? Are we going to need to factor in any external support? Are we going to factor, for example, one of the audits I did, DPIAs were prominent, a requirement in there. So that was in there. They sought out some DPIA trainings and so on. So it's about saying, do I have the internal resources and the roles and responsibilities defined in terms of what's an audit is done? So that's my fourth one. Phil, what's yours?
I skipped a whole load of stuff.
I had a feeling you might skip them.
my number four is be open and honest. You know, recognize your auditor is on your side. You know, if you, and the auditor's got this uncanny knack of walking down a corridor, I'm trying a door and it being open and it being full of files, you know, or turning up on site, which is my favourite trick, turning up an hour early and blagging my way in the building. And I've done this loads of times, you know, and wandering around as far as I can get. One place I went, the housing association, I think it was in Wales, actually. And the, I got in, somebody let me in. I said I'm here to do an audit, and they let me in. And the security guard had disappeared off on his rounds, and there was a contractor's badge left on the top. So it opened all the doors. So I went for a wander around. And then I was upstairs, climbed upstairs, went into this first floor kind of balcony looking over, mezzanine overlooking the reception desk. And the security, I could hear his music before I could see him. You know, listening to his music, he wanders up, you know, ambles around the desk, plonks himself down, and, you know, he's none the wiser what was going on. Anyway, so yeah, I think that for me, it's when the audit's on site, you know, everyone's got to accept, recognize really that we're there to help, we're there to highlight how things can be better, where things aren't right. Not because we're trying to be clever or we're trying to trip them up, but we're trying to ensure that the organization improves. You know, this whole cycle of continual improvement involves that compliance checking element. You know, and I think, you know, you often find people are nervous. Oh, God, it's the data protection auditor. Well, they are with me, but they're probably not with you, Jellic, but they are with me.
Do you know what it is? I was about to add on to that. And that's the one, as part of my audit kickoff, I do let the lead know. I say, look, it's up to you whether you want to do the introductions or whether you'd like to do pre-introductions beforehand. And I say, look, just... if there's one thing that I'd like you to communicate to them is that I'm there to, you know, to identify any gaps. And, you know, there's no nothing really wrong and right in terms of that. But when I do have the interviews with individuals, and I get told a few times, you're not a normal auditor is what I get told. You're not like the other auditors where they're a bit sharp and they got their whip out. Just like, no, that's not the point. I do assure them and say, look, we're both humans at the end of the day. We, you know, there are things that we might not be doing right, but if we identify those areas that need improvement, we can then do them. This is just your opportunity to tell me if there's something not right, and we'll identify them and I'll put some actions in place or recommendations and to get those improved. Because at the end of the day, data protection, what I find is not even people's day job or even week's job. They barely do much around data protection, so you can't expect them to know everything, but you need them to have an understanding. So I do kind of go in that approach as in, like, I'm the good cop. Just don't know where that bad cop is. But, yeah.
All right, good.
Completely
agree.
So
at what point did you have kind of been, you know, when you're actually in the audit? Was that your number five then, or is this – are we jumping – am I jumping about a bit more still?
Yeah, you're a bit jumpy, but that's okay, Phil. It's okay. My number fifth – so the fifth thing to bear in mind is – is how will you, so you need to put in place some form of a plan. How are you going to A, implement the actions, or how are you going to actually put this back into the operation? How are you going to measure its effectiveness? You know, once you put X, Y, and Z or recommendations in place, what do you want? How do you want to then monitor those sorts of stuff in terms of measuring your audit outcomes? So once it's out, how are you going to measure them? How are you going to put the remediation action plans in place? How are you going to distribute tasks? You know, are you, that's the point I'd say, consider reassessing whether you need additional budgets, whether you need additional resources, and whether you do need to put them. But that's where I would say is to kind of measure the
And do you split out, well, I know the answer to this question, but I want the answer from you. Do you split out two different types of action, sort of non-compliances, therefore you need a corrective action to correct the non-compliance, and recommendations, you know, when you're reporting back on, you know, I found this wasn't quite right. Again, I'm interested to get into the discussion about, well, what's your benchmark? Is your benchmark the same as my benchmark? You know, but to, you know, how do you distribute back and ring fence and categorize, you know, major non-compliances, minor non-compliances, recommendations? What's your approach there?
So those are non-compliance or non-conformities are where you're doing something wrong. For example, you do not log your breaches and there is no evidence of a risk assessment being undertaken. Now, that is a non-conformity because it doesn't, you know, how do you know what's the impact? Other things might be is if you say that you have a if you don't have procedures or policies in place that support the compliance operation. For example, you might not have a DPIA procedure that will tell or guide individuals on how to do risk assessments. So I will look at multiple things. So if somebody is telling me, for example, my staff monitor the security logs every morning, they're required to do so per the action list. And I say, right, okay, so then show us the action list. So if they have that and based on those, then that's obviously a recommendation to ensure that that's monitored and maintained. But if they do have, they have no compliance in terms of monitoring security logs and networks, then that's a non-conformity because you actually have no idea whether there are any incidents and breaches. So they're broken up into two. So three areas. First is your findings. So this is what I found based on interviews. This is what I found based on evidence. This is what I found based on what was supplied as part of the initial kickoff. Then the second is any non-conformities. It's very rare to have so many non-conformities. You know, I don't usually
these days. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Years ago, when the first GDPR was coming in and first came in, it was like, crikey.
Yeah, it is a bit like, I don't find many non-conformities with individuals.
So what is it you find then? Yeah, what
usually
do you
find in the non-conformities is things like they have absolutely no register for logging of breaches, or they are reusing. So, for example, I would give you a recent example. Somebody has a bank of photographs. They had consent back a few years ago, and what it is that they've decided they want a new campaign and they're reusing that images for a different purpose. That's a non-conformity because that's not what it was collected for originally. So now you're using it for something else, and which is a no-no. But then there are recommendations are things that, you know, things that you've spotted that could be improved on, or you feel like there wasn't enough time to really assess and delve into.
Yeah, let's say you're looking at training, training and awareness, and you know, there's induction training, you know, using an e-learning tool, and then there's you know, records of kind of refresher training. How would you regard that? Would you say that was acceptable, barely, perfectly fine, best practice? And what would your findings be? Well, we found out our induction and refresher training, you know, 98% of employees have been through this learning pool, 10-minute e-learning. What would your comments be there?
Oh, Phil, you targeted the low-hanging fruit. Training and awareness is one of the hottest area, and I can guarantee you it's always going to be the one that's followed up with a lot of recommendations. In most cases, half the time, you do find people are very much asset owners, process owners. They're very much confident with data protection. So you can tell that they're obviously competent in understanding how to implement the law in their area, for example, retention, minimization. So you already can come across that. But what I look at is, you know, I'm informed that there is an e-learning training. I'm informed that there might be regular training. I'm also informed any additional awareness campaigns. So that's what I get. So I already have that at the outset. Then what I do is when I'm interviewed, it depends on what the audit requirement is. I will then audit individuals. And usually it's quite senior levels, management levels. But also once in a while, I like to pick an individual, which I call a normal employee. I will pick one of those and then I will question them in terms of their knowledge around the data that they use. So, for example, if it's the photo management, we will look at those areas. But I do find that, Phil, a lot of the time is that when I delve in a bit deeper, saying, OK, so you are obviously you've got a retention process in place. OK, how do you audit? How do you know that you've got to align them? How do you know that you've got this sort of data? Because you've got children's information involved here. Did you know that there's extra care warranted here and so on? And that's when you usually pick up that actually they're not familiar with how actually data protection applies specifically to them. And that's usually the one thing that always gets highlighted is people have an understanding of data protection. They know it's about privacy, the protecting of rights. They understand that they have to protect information. They get the gist of it. But when you actually ask them, how does it apply to your area? You as a process owner who owns this highly sensitive information, do you know that you've got lawful reasons? You've got additional care that you need to apply. And that's usually where the risks will arise because they don't understand. And I am always, and it's surprising every single time, they always welcome additional training. And not just training. And the one thing that always gets highlighted, Phil, is that they always say, can the information be in a manner that I understand? You know, I don't understand the jargon. I get what I have to do, but I don't actually understand it. So therefore, they're not understanding how to apply it in their area. Yeah. So those
okay,
two.
Let me pick on another area then, because I'm interested in this, and these on to my next point, which is when you're auditing compliance checking, again, what are you expecting to find? An annual audit? Are you expecting to find internal auditors? You know, again, what do you find, and what do you think is a measure of good practice?
In terms of audit or training?
Audit. I've moved on from training. You didn't answer my question. So I'm not going to hold you to it. You're a bit of a politician. I get that. So I'm moving on.
No, that's fine. With audits, I found that some clients have already had external audits undertaken. I've also
who does them?
Oh, I'm not going to tell who they are because some of them are atrocious.
Well, that's the point that I'm trying to make. So my kind of point here is get yourself a decent auditor. Make sure they're a subject matter expert and ideally know the sector.
Yeah.
You know, because you can't get a financial auditor auditing this kind of stuff because, you know, what's the framework they're using? What experience have they got? How what are they bringing to the party? So yes, they've got audit skills, but they don't necessarily have the ability to train them on our field of work, same as I couldn't go and do a financial audit.
Yes, I found that where they've had a company that do the audits and they're predominantly really there for financial, but they have bolted on data protection and it's only just bits of it. So they kind of are looking for your basic stuff, like do you have a document or do you have this? They're not really delving into the point I would delve in. That external ones, I would say just, you know, if you are going to do an external one, and I see this often, at least half the time when I do the audits, external audits have been done, but nobody has put those actions into place. Nobody has addressed those and it's not been implemented in the business, whether that's resourcing, whether that's support and all sorts. So that's the one thing. The other thing I find as well is that people say, oh, well, we do tons of internal audits. And when I do look at internal audits and I delve in, sometimes I don't delve in because I don't want to make them feel bad. But there's usually
No,
what it is that it's usually them that's done the audit. And I feel a bit, I say, oh, do you know what? I don't want to delve in a bit deeper. But what you find is if you're the person that has to implement the processes, if you're responsible for driving, for assessing, for implementing, for advising the business on data protection, you can't be the one that does the audit because you're not picking up on important things.
Yeah.
So I've seen things in audits and I'm just saying, oh, that's why I feel I don't delve in a bit much around those areas because I know that it's the person that I'm speaking to that has done the audit. But it has to be someone different. It has to be someone that's away, especially IT.
Next point is impartiality. So, you know, in our business, for instance, you know, I don't want the DPO, the outsourced DPO or the privacy officer that we're putting on the site to doing the audits. That's why we've stripped you off and said, right, you're our dedicated audit resource because we need to check our own homework.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the audit's got to be impartial. Otherwise, it isn't really worth doing. It's going to get influenced, isn't it?
And they're not going to, with internal ones, what I find is that, you know, I'm sure, guys, you've come across this, but there are in some circumstances in which you don't get support internally. Therefore, you're kind of stuck on the areas you want to audit, the scope and so on. So sometimes, you know, you can't drive that internally. It depends on what really set up and structure you have in there.
Yeah. What's your thoughts? I'm going off a complete tangent here because it just popped into my head, actually. But what's your thoughts on COVID then? So, you know, we currently can't go on site. We've got partially finished audits in Guernsey, for instance. We can't get to Guernsey, you know, because of the travel restrictions. And I have done remote audits and actually they do work remarkably well, to be fair. But what's your personal thoughts on that? You've done remote audits, haven't you, Dilly?
I've done loads of remote ones. I'm in a bit of a love-hate relationship with this whole remote business because remotely, I can get more evidence. I can find out more and I can really see what's going on in terms of document systems because I request that some things are demonstrated via Teams or an alternative solution that's approved by the client. You know, it's different ways of receiving.
You can definitely cover more ground, can't you?
The other thing with remote is that there are some things you cannot track. For example, if I look at confidential bills, I get pictures sent to me about the confidential bins. Now, I can't see if that confidential bin is locked. I can't see if that bin is just like attached to something. It looks like a standard wheelie bin that can be dragged off. So I can't physically see those. And I've had people send me pictures of a door and I'm like, I cannot determine if that door is locked when no one walks in. So it has its...
I think one of the worst audits I did was at a private healthcare provider a couple of years ago in some part of the Midlands, and they told me all their data was in a data center in Derby. So I was absolutely flabbergasted when I opened a cupboard door and found it stacked full of servers or piling. In fact, they weren't even proper servers, were just big computers, and that was their data center. The backup was in Derby, but the data center was in this. And I said, why is the door not locked? Oh, because it overheats. We've got to keep opening it. What?
Yeah, you do identify those. But going back to the remote stuff, I think that there are some clients who are comfortable to disclose information to me in email. Some send it to me encrypted, and some who are not comfortable at all and therefore redact some of the information, which obviously usually I work with them in the right part where it's the part of the scope. So, you know.
So are you saying that the audit starts from the very moment you start receiving documentation and you're making an assessment? You know, is there a secure way of transferring documents? Am I putting words in your mouth?
Usually a part of the scope, that's what we define. We say, look, you know, if I need the evidence and they are comfortable, usually the client will set that at the beginning, but otherwise we'll discuss it at the beginning to say, I will need additional evidence, I will need potential screenshots, potential pictures and things like that. You happy to provide those through the email chain, but lock them in a password protected folder, which is usually what they do. But I've had other clients who send it password protected, but they redact all employees and third party mixed data in there so that there is no personal data. I don't really need to see personal data as such, but I do need to see that a process is there, that compliance is maintained. But then again, Phil, you might have individuals that are just not comfortable outright digitally because of their compliance, or depends on what data they're dealing with. It's just too risky for them to send it externally. But that's where you work with the client at the beginning to establish, are there going to be anything that could potentially impact it?
Yeah. And Andy's raised a fantastic point, and I want to just pick that up, which is that monitoring is often covered by security compliance, like in other areas. So, for instance, it could be that an organization's Cyber Essentials Plus, or they've got ISO 27001 or PCI DSS compliance. And I was interested that the ICO took into account PCI reports on compliance when they levied the fine on the Marriott Group. So again, when we're doing security, particularly security audits, because there are these mechanisms in place, to what extent do you have a look and say, well, you know, there is this certification which has been independently assessed and this is the scope of it, and therefore, you know, that would, because I think the ICO actually said in the Marriott case that they'd had appropriate measures in place, but it just hadn't worked because the report on compliance was rubbish. The QSA hadn't done a thorough job on it. So there's definitely crossover, isn't there? And some of these standards and voluntary codes and contractual things like the PCI DSS can actually kind of impact on and support a data protection audit.
I completely agree with that. When it comes to the technical side, that's not taken into account with a compliance audit because it's data protection and UK GDPR that's factored in. But I completely understand.
It's a light touch, isn't it? It's a light touch.
Yes, very light touch. I want to see that you have policies and procedures. I want to see that you monitor your compliance and there's evidence of it. I want to see that your project remit contains the screening questions, and
we want to see that there's a method for determining what's appropriate. I mean, we're not going to make that judgment necessarily. We might well make a judgment that we don't think that's appropriate security for that type of processing in that type of context. But we need to see that there's a method for doing that. Because if there isn't a method for doing it, then how are you going to demonstrate that you are doing it against the sixth principle?
I'm conscious of time, but I will go into my last three, Phil, and then I'll leave. That's it. Well, you know, it's a process.
Go on, get your foot down, Dilik.
It's worse than Phil at trying to control how long he's going to test.
Sorry, I'm very bossy. So the next one is ensure that... So the next one is to ensure that there's internal resources dedicated to support and implement these controls. So if you need a system, you know, making sure that it's funded, or, you know, if a process is required. So that's the key thing. And also to determine whether you need external resources. You know, it's really about budgeting in that point of view, and also who is going to be involved. My seventh point is to it's a really, I've just put oversight and engagement, here we go, oversight and engagement from the leadership once an audit is done. And I think that's why so many external ones that I've come across when they give me reports has been unsuccessful, I'd say, in implementing, is because there might be a little investment or commitment or support, or there's even like a little drive, I'm trying to be as nice as possible, lack of drive from the leadership level and driving this through at senior, because that's literally how it's all going to really take into account and embed it into compliance. Mm-hmm. If it's driven in leadership, if they are monitoring,
it's got to be in the culture, hasn't it? It's exactly. Got to be embedded in the culture, and that's the job of leadership to some extent.
And I found that there are some circumstances in which areas have been highlighted, but the commitment of the leadership or the objective is to, for example, more digitize and things like that. And therefore, risk assessment seems to be like it's going to hinder their processes. So, you know, it's about making sure that leadership, A, has oversight over compliance, because you want to make sure that they know what the risks are associated, especially if they are owning of that data area. So investment, commitment and support to drive that delivery of the compliance across. And it doesn't matter. So the next one is, and my last one, Phil, before I let you go. I know you're eager, but I thought I'd get this out. So the next one is to ensure that there's a frequent auditing undertaken, whether you want to do internal ones following on from the external ones to make sure they're embedded. But it's about making sure people expect frequent audits to be done, that, you know, this is standard operation, that this is embedded into the culture, and there's continual oversight over compliance, so that you know, okay, so we know here are our risks and we are monitoring those, because you have to, and I always say visibility over those. So it's about making sure that it's embedded, that audit is a normal practice that we're going to have in place. Data protection is going to be, you know, whether you do it annually and then every 6 months do an internal one, so that there's nothing of surprise as such. But I would say that, yep, oversight of it by implementing it frequently. But that's it from my end, Phil. Sorry, guys.
That's fine.
I get too carried away with audits.
No, listen, I wanted to just go through this, right? So, again, this might be obvious to everyone, and I apologise if it is. But whenever we're doing, or whenever I'm doing an audit, whether it's of a ROPA or a breach, you know, situation, not a breach situation, a breach, sort of compliance with the requirements around personal data breaches or retention or, you know, privacy information, I take, and you comment in on this as well, Dilik and guys, I look for a policy. Is there a policy that defines the overall direction of travel and an attitude of the organization towards this aspect of data protection compliance management? Then I look for, is there a procedure? So it might be a high-level policy, but, you know, how is that broken down into steps that you have to take to appoint a processor, to decommission a process, to report an incident, to evaluate whether a harm is likely to occur and therefore, you know, whether it's a personal data breach, and if it is it reportable? So the procedures are critical, aren't they? So you've got to have a policy and a procedure in every area, in my view. And then I'm going out saying, well, are people aware about this? You know, it's all right having my policies and procedures in my SharePoint, but if people aren't aware of it and it isn't in general use, then it isn't embedded, and therefore you're not compliant, in my opinion. So then I'm after that, I'm looking for, okay, is there evidence of these things working? You know, is there a record of a breach, and you know, was it handled in line with the requirements? Are there ROPAs? You know, are those ROPAs any good? They've got holes in them. You know, can I find processing activities on the floor when I'm out and about that aren't on the ROPAs? And equally, can I find things on the ROPAs that I can go and drill into when I'm on the walkabout? So I'm looking at, you know, the records then. That's the evidence-based stuff, isn't it, we're doing on the site.
Yeah.
After that, I'm looking at, right, okay, you know, do these procedures actually meet the requirements set out in the law? Are they any good? You know, and very often you read a privacy notice, you know, yeah, they've got a privacy notice, they might have a procedure for writing them, but the privacy notice is not very good. You know, there's bits missing out of it. And then the final thing,
tone and language as well of those documents. You know, if you're speaking to individuals, and a lot of the time, Phil, they will, so after you've done the interviews and reviewed the after you review the documents, you'll find that people don't understand those. They say, well, I kind of get some of the information, but I just don't get the language or the jargon or what I'm actually supposed to do. So it's about executing those duties. They usually don't understand those procedures because they're written in such a complex way.
And then the final thing that I'm going to look for as an auditor in each of these topical areas is there evidence of these things, procedures, policies, etc., being reviewed? And I have to say, twice this week I've jumped in and done some support tickets, you know, can you review this policy for us? And on both occasions, the review date was last year, March last year. So the first thing I'm pointing out is, why are you overshooting your review dates? You know, if you're having a review date, review it. And if you're not having a review date, you know, don't put it on there. Because as an auditor, there's nothing worse than people saying, we're going to do this, and then not doing it. I mean, I guess it, we're there to help them, aren't we? But so that's kind of my approach. I don't know if yours differs. Policy, procedure, awareness, evidence of it working. Is that documentation any good at meeting the requirements? And is there evidence of this stuff getting reviewed periodically?
Same with yours.
Is it?
Yeah, very much same, Phil. You just explained it in a much condensed way.
I think you're spot on, Phil. And I think the value in it can be highlighted sometimes when things go wrong. So as some of you are aware, and I can't go into it too much by virtue of the nature of the work, but I've been doing some root cause analysis on a personal data breach for a client recently. And as soon as you start digging there, they say, oh, well, it's human error. Things happened, you know, and you go, okay, fine. But what's actually happened? And you start digging, and then you start finding things like, oh, well, this policy or this procedure in particular, it doesn't actually work right. When was the last time you actually reviewed this procedure? When did you actually test it? Mm. All right, fine. That's a mistake. It happens. Then you go, okay, can I see a breach form for the incident? Oh, well, there's no breach form. And all this, and you keep digging. And it's clear that a thorough audit almost certainly would have, you know, weeded a lot of this out and would have brought it to light, and you could have addressed it. And then maybe you're avoiding a personal data breach, which is now reportable and could get you on the commissioner's radar. Mm-hmm. So I think the value is all too often, you know, in when things go wrong, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Also, yeah. I think what we, I don't know if we have covered it before I came on, but you know, it's all right having a, you know, an audit being done, but the importance of doing on job, on the site, in department audits, you know, some, you know, whoever's the lead of data protection should be doing.
That's a great point, Kathy. We haven't talked about that actually.
I know you haven't. That's why I'm saying it.
Yeah, we did talk about who's meant to be doing these things. And I'll give you a real quick example. I turned up at an audit in Suffolk years ago. I got there early, got in, sat in the foyer. I might have said this before to you. 30 white bags of confidential waste sat on the floor. I went for a walk around at 2 p.m. You know, that day. So it's like 8 hours later. Well, maybe I wasn't there that early, it felt like it, and the bags are still there. I sent to the guys showing me around, the head of IT, what's all this then? He said, well, it's a confidential waste, meant to get collected today. So it's sitting there for a whole day open, the bags are all open. So I put my hand in, pulled out a load of paperwork, it's all HR records. I said, you know, whose responsibility is it, Jamie, to sort this stuff out? Oh, it's mine, but I've been with you. I said, no, you're wrong, it's everyone's responsibility. Every employee had walked past to sign in and walked out to go for their lunch, and nobody had picked up that all these confidential waste was sitting around opened. It's everyone's job, and that's really what we've got to try and get across. It's not your job as the auditor, Dilik. It's not my job as it's not, you know, the participants here. Everybody should be the eyes and ears. We should have zero tolerance in our organizations for privacy risk.
But also, when Dilik's doing an audit, you know, and she starts to interview people, you know, the chances are that they've never actually been audited within their department, and they're going to get caught out because, you know, it's not something they're used to. Mm. You know, they should be, you know, every department head should be auditing their own department at least every 6 months for data protection. So that one, that, you know, the guys who work in there are familiar, and it's revising, you know, what's in place, making sure they know the policies and procedures. But it's an area that's mostly neglected.
Yeah. I tell you, we'd run out of time, unfortunately. But I was interested because we're going to build the audit or finish off the building of the audit for the Age Appropriate Design Code of Practice. Again, that's going to be interesting because there's a framework for the Age Appropriate Design Code of Practice, but there's no audit methodology. So we're going to be building that out or finishing off our build of that in the next few weeks. But tricky areas to do, Dilik. You know, privacy by design and by default, how do you audit that? I mean, that's a cultural thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's tricky, isn't it, sometimes to get on top of that. I mean, PECA is another one where often they're not really specified in a GDPR audit, but really we want to get under the skin of the Privacy and Electronic Commons regulations, don't we, and find out what's going on and whether it's being done properly, you know, cookies and email marketing, and maybe that's a separate audit, but you know, we try and cover that, don't we, when we're talking to marketing, but it's another area that's quite tricky because you're looking for records of consent where you might be doing unsolicited direct marketing.
Yeah, definitely.
Now then, Dave's been very quiet. He's either gone for a cup of tea or he's left the building.
Can't get word in edgeways with you two.
Sorry.
Right, Miles has put up what's coming on. I'm sorry that we've run out of time. I'm sorry if we've rabbited on a lot, but you know what we're like. We do like talking about this kind of stuff. So next week, what we're talking about, Miles, is it 26th next week? Data breaches.
Yeah.
All right, okay. So I think the idea of this was to pick up some of the ICOs, some of the recent enforcement action, wasn't it, from memory, and delve into it and try and identify, you know, what went wrong and what lessons we might pull out of these things. Was that what we're talking about generally?
Yeah.
Right, okay. And then so we've got that coming up, and then we've got some, so we're going to try and go alternate weeks. So we're going to have more of a kind of a topical focus every other week, and then quite an open session talking about the news and guidance and, you know, bits and bobs every other week. We're going to try that for a couple of weeks and see how that works. But again, if you've got things you want us to talk about, then, you know, put them into the mix. I think we've probably run out of time. So thank you, Dilik. It's been fabulous to get you on one of these, because you usually avoid them, talking about, I know, something that's close to your heart. I did want to also explore, which we didn't really get a chance to, the kind of the link between DPAs and audits. And I was going to highlight, which I'll send a link round, the old Privacy Impact Assessment Handbook, the ICO launched in 2007, because again, that's a really good document. I think it's much better than the existing DPIA documentation. So unless there's anything else, we probably should pack up and crack on with the afternoon. So thank you, Dave and Ollie and Kathy, and especially Dilik. Thank you, everyone, for joining us today. I hope it was interesting or useful, and hope you have a good weekend, and hope to see you next week.
Yeah, no, thank you very much, everybody. And thank you, Dilik, for your input. Sorry, I was quiet on this occasion, but I was actually trying to find a bit of airtime.
But it was
all very interesting and relevant. So I didn't want to spoil that with anything that I came in with. But it's it was certainly very interesting to sit back and listen for once.
Thanks, everybody.
Yeah.